وَإِنُ عَمَدُ نَعَيَ لُوهِنُ وَلِنُ مَأَسِي دِنُ وَكُنُ نَعَلِنُ مَأَسِي دِنُ وَكُنُ نِهُ
Shalom Aleichem, Baruchim Abayim. Welcome everyone. As Be'ezrat Hashem, we begin our lesson today in Sefer Bereshit, the book of Genesis, the third perek, chapter 3. This is the story of all stories, the mother of all stories, the serpent, the Eve, the eating of the tree of knowledge, good and evil, the fall. What on earth is this all about? We must understand the foundations, as I have shared with you in previous lessons, that biblical teachings, especially of this nature, are to be understood metaphorically and not literally. This has always been a big problem, because as we very well know, throughout the imagery that has been portrayed in Western society literally for thousands of years, we interpret the snake as looking like a traditional snake of today. People are always questioning, well, gee, what was the forbidden fruit? Was it an apple? Some rabbis say it was a fig, some say it was a grape, some say it was an etrog. You know something? We go back into the most ancient of Jewish commentaries, written in the day of the Holy Temple itself. And some might say, why do you go back to Jewish commentaries? And I say, well, maybe it's because the Bible was like Jewish, and there was no other kind of commentaries in the day. There was no Christian, Islam, or anybody else. The Bible was written by Jews, for Jews. Who do you think would have been the people who were rewriting the oldest commentaries on them? Obviously, the people who read the books. Jews. So, when we go into the most ancient of tellings of the stories, even the likes of Josephus, a point that he makes very clearly in his beginning chapters of his Jewish Antiquities, is to explain to, remember, he's not necessarily writing this for a Jewish audience or a Jewish educated audience, and to explain to them how when Moses was writing, he doesn't necessarily use the same terminology that we have in the past, speaking about what we call Hebraic mentality, but he does explain the concept. Remember, the people in his day are the Greco-Roman educated philosopher-oriented type individuals. And therefore, he's explaining to them the concept of metaphor, symbolic usage of terms, which is a concept very well understood in Greco-Roman society, because Greco-Roman society had their own versions of this. I might remind you that the whole concept of drama and acting had its source in the Greco-Roman culture. So they're very well familiar with the whole concept of symbolism and metaphor. And we must understand that when it comes to this telling of a story. Because things are not literal. What exactly do they mean? You know something? That term exactly is one of those funny words, simply because I can give you a rendition in accordance to the most oldest of sources of how this was understood. And that's exactly my plan of what I'm hoping to accomplish in this lesson. But what exactly happened? Well, you want to know something other than if we could take a time machine and go back and, like, record it. I don't know if we will ever know exactly anything. We have a record. We are taught to understand the record within a context. We are given certain insights. And all we can do is discuss them, embrace them, and walk away from this chapter with the lessons meant for us to be able to embrace and learn. Because remember, even though Genesis is telling us the story, if you will, of man, it is not written as a history book to explain to us what happened on day 1, day 2, day 3, etc. But rather, it is a story to teach us morals. The entire purpose of Moses, including the entire book of Genesis in the Torah, is, if you will, to bring us up to snuff for what is happening in his own day and what's covered in the rest of the Bible from the book of Exodus through Deuteronomy. The entire concept of the history here is to place within us a context. And I might add right from the beginning here, when we're going to discuss what we're going to call the fall in the garden, there is no such biblical concept as what has been embraced by later non-Jewish theologians as something called original sin. Sin is a choice of behavior. It is not a state of being. The words in Hebrew, avera, or chet, or avon, which are the original Hebrew words that describe sin, all have to do with behavior. There can be no original state of behavior, because behavior is a choice that we make at the moment. You choose to do the right thing or the wrong thing. You cannot be, therefore, in a state of original bad behavior. Now, we do have a concept well known within the Jewish tradition about the two inclinations of mankind. We call it a Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa, the good inclination and the bad inclination. All these are terms to describe, if you will, aspects within the human personality which seek the higher good or seek debasement. I don't mean the basement below your house. I mean, you know, to do things which are not necessarily for the highest good. And I might add, just as a slight tangent, nowhere in Judaism do we teach pursuing the wants or needs, or for that matter, the desires of physical living, is in any way being wrong. Unlike the Greco-Roman philosophy based on Persian Mithraic Zoroastrian teachings, we do not in Judaism hold a dichotomy of good and evil to describe the difference between spiritual and physical. In other words, the physical is just as good and holy as is the spiritual. And therefore, to enjoy the good things of the world is just as holy as to enjoy spiritual things. So then, what's the definition of evil? Definition of evil is with everything. Overdoing it. You can enjoy that delicious, rich, indulgent chocolate bar. But then again, you might not want to eat an entire meal of them and repeat that every single day until such a point where you've gained such terrible amounts of weight that you're endangering your health. There is a matter of balance and there's a matter of imbalance. That is the proper understanding in the Torah Jewish tradition of, if you will, good and evil. Keep that in mind now when we come into our story. Chapter 3 opens up speaking about the Nachash, the serpent. And that's such an interesting choice of word, because in Hebrew numerology, the word Nachash, snake, has the same exact numerical value of a word which is going to pop up much later called Mashiach, the Redeemer. And our sages teach us here that one cancels out the other. And why is that important to mention here? Because it might help us to understand the nature of how Adam and Eve could have been so confused by this individual. The Nachash was most cunning of all the wild beasts that God had made. Our sages say with regards to the Nachash, as we know the famous story, he enters into a conversation with Eve and convinces her to eat of the forbidden fruit. And as we will read the story, we know the rest. But a point that our sages make from the most ancient of sources, and I'll even quote to you now Josephus from his Jewish Antiquities, Book 1, Chapter 1, where he states, all living creatures at this time had one language. And even the serpent at that time spoke. And that we know. Our other rabbis teach, based upon a understanding where God punishes the serpent, we know, says you're going to go on your belly. Originally, the serpent stood upon feet, had arms. Now, if he's a serpent, then he's a reptile. And if he's standing on feet with arms, then he's a reptilian humanoid. Gee, that sounds like something really weird, doesn't it? But that's exactly how the serpent is described, as a reptilian humanoid. We find a reference to that in traditional biblical literature, specifically in the book of Isaiah chapter 6, where in which Isaiah has a vision of a certain type of an angel who are called seraphim. Now, seraphim could be interpreted as burning ones, but the word seraph also means a serpent, a reptilian type of a being. And that is very important for us to understand, because the serpent here, as is brought down by the most ancient of biblical commentaries or translations called the Yonatan ben Uziel, in his Aramaic translation / commentary, he specifically makes a reference to the serpent as being a specific angel. We call that angel Samech Mem, Samakel. We don't even mention his name properly. This is the true fallen angel, the leader of the rebellion, if you will, against God. Now, this angelic rebellion against God is not necessarily mentioned in the Bible at all. However, it is mentioned in a tremendous amount of other literature, which was never codified as part of the Bible. And I'm specifically referring to the books of Enoch. Now, Enochian literature has very much played a role in later Jewish midrashic teachings, specifically of the mystical kind, which we find in the foundations of the writings of what we call the Kabbalah, the secret traditions in Judaism. This genre of literature was the foundation of much of what we know of Qumranic Essenic teachings, and of course make up a large amount of the library at Qumran, which was found years later. It is actually also a fundamental foundational role in the development of Christian teachings, or in which the book of Enoch is even quoted in the Christian Bible, if I'm not mistaken, in the Epistle of Jude, and mention is made there. So this Enochian literature, spoken of in tremendous amount of Jewish sources, also referring to Genesis in later chapters, where it speaks of the sons of God who came down and took the daughters of men, which many of our rabbis make a reference to these fallen angels. In Enoch, referencing this again chapter in Genesis, there was some type of a prehistoric war in heaven, where in which a group of angels rebelled against God. Now we say, being that angels are not on the level of consciousness of humanity, and do not have what we call free will, how is that possible that they could choose to do something that God would not otherwise want? Well, that's a good question. Something to be dealt with at another time, because it's outside of the parameters of our story. The reason why I'm even going into this right now is to help us understand where the serpent came from and what is motivating him to do what he does. The rabbis have brought down a tremendous amount of what we call midrashic tales, stories that have been passed down through the centuries. Apparently, we find the foundations of which are Qumranic in nature, Essenic, and maybe even more ancient than that, which speaks that at the time of the creation of man, the angels came forth before God and protested and said, God, why are you creating this race of beings called Adam? Let us accomplish the tasks for which you are creating them. Now, just as a point here, the angels were allegedly created on day 2, and later some others on day 5. Now remember, the times of these days of creation, from our point of view, maybe are only individual days, but from God's point of view, thousands and millions and billions of years have gone by. So these races of angels have been around for, judging how we judge time today, a really, really long time. They've been doing things for God at his behest for a long time, billions of years. We're talking about races created by the Creator that have been around for millions, if not billions of years. We can imagine how advanced they must be, how close to God they must be,
So much so that God refers to them as His agents, His messengers. In the Hebrew, we call them malachim, which we translate as angels. Of this group, when God decided that the evolution of the universe required the creation of man, a group said, why? And this led to, if you will, a civil war in the universe, not limited to planet Earth. We call it a war in heaven. But where that was and what that was, again, outside the parameters of our present context. We're here to discuss chapter 3, not the prehistoric angelic wars. But nonetheless, we find a battle in that war happening right now. You see, this race of beings, who we call the Seraphim, this angelic race, it is allegedly from their ranks that the leader of their ranks, who is Samakel, fell. These reptilian entities fell to Earth, or came to Earth. It's a matter of how we're going to understand it. And that is why one of them is called the Nachash, a reptilian humanoid being. And interesting, when we speak of these Seraphim angels, their present head is one who has the name Metatron, which is actually a Greek word meaning the guardian. He is the angel spoken of in Parshat Mishpatim in the book of Exodus as the one who led the children of Israel in the desert. The one who has God's name in him. Because his name Metatron is the numerical value of 314, the same as God's holy name Shin Dalet Yud Shaddai. This angel, this guardian angel, who others will call Michael, is the guardian angel of Israel. And in some way is related to the soul of Enoch, Hanoch ben Yared, who we read about later in Genesis, and also somewhere related to the soul of Mashiach. Again, that interesting coincidence of the numerical connection of the word Nachash being 358 and the word Mashiach being 358. So we have all of these connections here subtly intertwining before us. The serpent is called cunning. The Hebrew word is arum, which actually means naked, crafty. Even Josephus has a very curious choice when he says here that the serpent showed an envious disposition. He was jealous. Some say, well, what was he jealous of? Some will say, oh, he's jealous of Eve. Well, why? Oh, he wanted Eve for himself. Now, why? If he was human, then I could understand a human being jealous for another man's wife. But if he is of an entirely different species, well, let me ask you this. When was the last time you went to the zoo and got really sexually attracted to a turtle, crocodile, or a snake? Unless you're really sick and perverted, I don't think that was the case. And needless to say, it wasn't the case here with the serpent. He had an agenda, an envious agenda. And we can turn to the likes of the Yonatan Ben Uziel commentaries, I will in a moment, and we'll recognize what that agenda is. Serpent speaks to the woman. Did God really say to you that you may eat of any of the trees of the garden? The woman replied to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit of the tree of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree that's in the middle of the garden, he said, don't eat it and don't even touch it, or else you will die. Now, before I will comment on these words, let's go into an issue here. The woman is entering into dialogue with the serpent. That was problem number one. What's she talking to him about? Our sages teach us that the serpent, at this time, this reptilian humanoid, similar in likes to the seraph angel, was actually Adam's trusted companion, his right hand, his most faithful friend, and if you will, servant. And therefore, the one
who would speak and communicate. Josephus says that all the animals in the garden spoke. But here, we only have a reference of that being the serpent. Now, just another point I want to make reference of here. How many serpents were in the garden? How many of these reptilian-type beings were there? The Bible only speaks of one. But remember, he's a created being. We should never apply the concept of Noah's Ark here to the garden to think there was only one of each animal. Nowhere does it say that. The world was teeming with all types of species. The only species that was singular at this time was Adam. So this serpent was only one of many. And this is the one that came and approached Eve. Now, some rabbis state that only Eve heard the voice of the serpent and not Adam. And in all due respect here, Genesis 3 only speaks of the conversation between Eve and the serpent. There was no conversation with Adam. Some are of the opinion that Adam would not have been deceived in this way. He wouldn't have been tricked because he was wiser. But Eve, for whatever reason, as we will learn in a moment what that reason was not. Woman was closer to speaking with the animals because she was closer to nature. We find the reflections of this centuries later, that again in the book of Exodus, when the prohibition against witchcraft is mentioned, it always speaks of a female witch as opposed to the male. And the male and female are involved in the occultic practices almost equally. But we know and recognize that the power of the female is much stronger in that respect than with the male, because the female was much closer to the spiritual source of things, which we can call the serpent. But not all serpents were evil. Only this one was, because he had an agenda. As you know, the serpent says to the woman, "You're not going to die. God knows that on the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." The Aramaic commentary says something very profound. He says, "You will be like the great angels, wise in knowing the ways of good and evil, and thus you can become like God." Now, what's so wrong about that? Well, actually, that was the fundamental reason behind the original civil war of the angels. They challenged the Creator in the creation of Adam. They wanted to usurp the role of Creator. And because of that, it led to a great war with their forces, their dominions being cast out of what we called heaven, now coming to earth, and bringing that same, what did Josephus call it? Envious disposition into Adam. This was a continuation of their battle against the Creator. And they were, in essence, trying to seduce Adam through Eve to join their rebellion. Now, that's not exactly what happened, but their damage was clear. Number one, God never commanded Adam not to touch the tree of knowledge, good and evil. He says, just don't eat it. You can touch it all you want. Pet it, stroke it, hug it if you want. Go hug a tree. He says, just don't eat it. Now, what exactly what this fruit was, again, wasn't an apple, grape, fig, or anything of the kind. It was not a it's not a physical fruit. It's a metaphor for an involvement in certain type of activity. Just let's leave it at that. Because Adam and Eve were not ready to involve themselves in this type of activity. Adam, according to our sages, added to Eve the additional prohibition, don't touch it. Because he knew very well her nature of being very close to the earth and having natural curiosity. But by adding this fence, he also created a stumbling block that the serpent, being wise, arum, naked in his wisdom, recognized well, I could trip him up over this. And he says, you're not going to die. Go ahead, touch it. She touches it. She didn't die. So what does she logically conclude? Then touch it and die. Gee, I guess I can eat it and I won't die. Is that true? No, it's not. But the woman saw that the tree was good, desirable to the eyes, and the tree was attractive as a means to gain intelligence. So what was the original sin? Desire, craving, trying to achieve something that is not yours to achieve, to take something which is not yours to take. Desire, craving. Now, we're all human, we're all desirous. No one said you couldn't be hungry. No one said you couldn't even eat of the tree of life, which was accessible to them. But here, there was a parameter, a boundary set, and a desire to go against that boundary. And because there was a cloud of vision, not for the sake and purpose and intent to rebel, but rather for the sake and the purpose to expand. Eve wanted to acquire intelligence. She truly, what is this good and evil? I want to know. To be like gods. Isn't that good? Aren't we supposed to want to bear ourselves? All due respect, I'm coming close to be like God. Isn't that a good thing? Well, it can be, I guess, if it's done in a right way. Meaning that if they followed the orders of heaven, they would have come to the natural outcome of heaven. But by aligning themselves, even inadvertently, with those who rebelled, they're going about it the wrong way. And as the old saying goes, the right means in the wrong hands causes the right means to work in the wrong way. So rather than become closer, they fell further. And that's exactly what happened here in the garden. Continuing, it says here she also gave some to her husband, and he ate it. Why? How? Our sages offer some very profound and interesting stories of how this occurred. They said that she actually disguised the fruit and gave it to Adam in a form that he would not recognize and know. And that is why he took it as well. But nonetheless, the next verse immediately states, the eyes of both of them were open, they realized that they were naked. Now, what happened? Did the serpent lie? Actually, no, he didn't. He never said to them, if you eat of this, you wouldn't have intelligence. They gained intelligence. Our sages said that immediately their eyes were opened. Now, let me give an example to you which will help you maybe understand this. Let us play a game of Russian roulette. You know what that is. You take a bullet and you shoot yourself in the head. And I say, go ahead, shoot yourself in the head and you'll see what heaven is like. And gee, don't we all want to go to heaven? Sure we do. So, you take the bullet and shoot yourself in the head, and what happens right away? You die. And all of a sudden, as you're dead, you see the spiritual world. And you will see heaven. But notice I didn't say you get to go there. Because you can also have before you hell. And based upon where you're at the moment, will define where you end up. Did I lie to you? No. Did you end up where you thought you would? No. This is exactly where Adam and Eve were. In essence, by eating of the fruit, which is again a metaphor, a symbol for partaking of a certain type of an action, if you will, similar to shooting yourself in the head, they fell from their high spiritual state, how they existed prior to the fall, wherein which Adam and Eve did not know death. There was no concept of the physicality as we understand it today. They were spiritual beings that lived, as we clearly see, amongst the angels. And this act of this eating, this metaphorical eating, caused them to fall into the physical world and into the present form of flesh and blood that we exist in today. Now, originally, they could have come into the physical world of flesh and blood at will and go back into the spiritual world at will. Unlike us today, we have to go through a process called death to go back into the spiritual. We cannot come back to the physical. There is no open doorway between the two. Originally, for Adam, there was. There was no concept of death. Like Elijah the prophet. You could be physical, go up to heaven, come back down again. Go back up again, go back down again. There was no separation between what we call the heavens and the earth. Adam was a composite being who existed simultaneously in both. But this act of eating got us stuck here. Their eyes were opened. They recognized what had happened. They were naked. What does naked mean? Stripped bare. Not having the ability of movement, of covering. And therefore it says they sewed fig leaves and made themselves loin cloths. Many people say, oh, they were embarrassed of their sexuality. I don't know why. And why only the loin cloths to cover the genitalia and not the upper areas, which are also sexual. But again, we're talking a metaphor. What happens next? They heard God's voice moving about in the garden with the wind of the day. Right? Man and his wife hide themselves from God amongst the trees of the garden. God calls out to man, and he says in the Hebrew, Ayeka, where are you? Why are you trying to hide? Now, God's a dummy, chas v'shalom, God forbid. He doesn't know what happened? Of course he knows. He's not watching? Of course he's watching. He doesn't know what the angels intend? Of course he does. Did he intend for this to happen? No. He gives us the choice. You see, in a quantum universe where there are multiple choices that could happen simultaneously, God had, if you will, chosen the path for mankind, plan one, but made all the contingencies, if you will, for plan B, plan number two, that if and when we chose this path, which apparently we did, so he allowed it to happen, knowing that this course of action could be followed. Not the best one, but, you know something? People make choices. Sometimes intelligently and sometimes not. The choice was made. God says, where are you now? The question that he had to ask for himself? No, it's a rhetorical question that he's asking man. Where are you now? Okay, now that you did it, where are you now? To which Adam has to answer. And what does he say? Well, you know, I heard your voice in the garden. Voice? What is a voice? Right? Voice of Hashem, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei Elokim, the union of the spiritual, not physical. Voice. Voice is the movement, the power of creation. I felt your creative force here in my presence. And I was afraid because I was naked. I had somehow stripped myself of my spiritual essence. He's still in the garden. Garden is still spiritual. But now as a physical composite, limited in his spiritual capacity, he is incongruent for the garden. A comparison. If man was originally created with both lungs to breathe air and gills to breathe under the water, and all of a sudden does something which makes his gills disappear and he can't breathe under the water anymore. What do you think? Do you think we should have man still living under the seas? No, he can't. It's just incongruent. He doesn't have what it takes. So it was. He didn't have the ability to maintain his physical presence in the garden in his present physical status. So, he hides. He's trying to avoid the situation, but he can't. God says, who told you you were naked? Right? As if he didn't know the answer. Did you eat from the tree I commanded you not to eat? How does he say? Yes, I did. I violated your commandment. I did it. I'm sorry. No, he didn't fess up to that, didn't he? He immediately blames his wife, points the finger. Some people say, aha, typical man behavior. But whoa. Let's not apply modern day conflict of male and female to this story, because it's not true. Where does it say that Adam consciously chose to do this? He didn't. As I said, our sages say very clearly, he was deceived into doing this. And when we review the curses, we will find this to be apparent. Because as we're going to learn, God curses Eve for her choice. God curses the serpent for his choice. But God never directly curses man. He curses the earth and makes man's relationship to it difficult. But he never curses man himself. He tells the truth. The woman that you gave to be with me, she gave me what I ate from the tree. Now, why does he say it like that? Because she was supposed to be his helpmate, his trusted companion, the one who comes from his essence and heart, who would never betray him, never lie to him, never mislead him. That is the role and nature of a wife to a husband, that he is supposed to be able to rely upon her 1,000%. And that's why he says, didn't you create her to be this? I listened to her because I'm under the impression that's what you wanted me to do. She, the one you gave me, she gave. Does God say to her, but you should have known better? No. Does God say to Adam, why did you listen? No. He understood. And he turns to the woman. No. What'd you do? And she says, the serpent, that Nahash, he did this, right? He tricked me, and I ate it. How did he trick her? What did he do? Did he say anything that was a lie? No, he didn't, did he? He said very clearly, your eyes will be opened. Just like I said to you, shoot yourself in the head, and I promise you, your eyes will be open to spiritual reality. Guarantee, it will. Shoot yourself in the head, you'll see heaven. Doesn't mean you'll get there. You'll see it, maybe from a distance. That's exactly what happened here. She didn't understand that. She didn't get it. She didn't draw the natural conclusions that Adam would have. We teach that the relationship of Adam and Eve is, if you will, the relationship of head to heart. That the woman truly embraces the heart, while man the head. And that is actually implied here. Because the woman did not analyze. She didn't contemplate this intellectually. She desired, she craved aspects relating to the heart. And because the heart embraced, the head followed. And that's exactly what happened here. But the heart itself was deceived. Oh, what are we learning here? Very practical and real lessons about ourselves. So God points the finger back to the serpent, the Nahash, the Saraph. And he goes, oh, you're the one, huh? Sam, that's you, isn't it? The one who led the insurrection. You had to come down here and mess things up. And here he says, because of this, you are cursed more than all the livestock and the wild beasts. On your belly shall you crawl, the dust shall you eat all the days of your life. This is both a reference to maybe a biological change in the reptilian nature of the original snakes, but also what we can refer to as the casting down of the angels to the earth, the fallen ones who show up later in Genesis as the ones who take the daughters of men. That is extremely relevant because their presence has followed us throughout the entire biblical story. These fallen angels are always out there. And they always have, if you will, as if claim to man. So much so that in later tradition, as we find written in the book of Leviticus, God commands the holy Yom Kippur sacrifice for the atonement of sins. Two goats are chosen, one for Hashem and another for Azazel, who our sages say is this fallen angel. Another name for him. Just like angels of holiness have multiple names, so do the fallen ones, based upon a whole bunch of different reasons that I don't have to get into right now. God says on that day, because of the sins that we do, he deserves a share. And they would take a goat, not sacrificed, but they would take it, literally throw it off a cliff, and it died. And that was given to the dark side as its due. We're always told to give the devil his due. Actually, it has a very profound psychological concept. We all have that part of ourselves which wants to do. You know something? There's nothing wrong with wanting to do as long as what is done, as I said, is not done in excess or to the point of harm. That's given the devil his due. Very important concept here which we find throughout the Torah. Now, verse 15. I will plant hatred between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He will strike you in the head and you will strike him in the heel. A metaphor of the conflict between, if you will, head and heart, between the desires of the world and the desires of spirit. Conflict between you and the woman, your offspring and her offspring. Striking on the head. Right? The only way to destroy that which seeks to lead us astray is to hit it in the head, using the forces of intellect to analyze, to destroy. Right? And you'll strike them on the heel. To show us that when the forces of evil wish to attack us, they try to like bite us in the heel, which means to trip us up how we walk. And when we stumble and fall, how do you handle that? With your head. All this is metaphorical language. And somehow I know that in the Christian tradition, they have taken this to be some type of a Christological prophecy, somehow related to Christ. There is absolutely nothing messianic of any reference here at all. How they extrapolate such a message is totally outside the pale of the historical, factual context of the verse. But people do as people do. But now, to the curses. As a result of this fall, God says to the woman, I will greatly increase your anguish in your pregnancy. It will be an anguish that you will give birth to children. Your passion will be to your husband and he will dominate you. Four things here a woman suffers as she came into the physical world. Number one, menstruation. Number two, the pains of childbirth. Number three, desire and craving for a man. And number four, being submissive to the man. All four of these are said to be curses, punishments that a woman has to suffer in this world. And I can just imagine every woman listening say, oh, boy, do we suffer. I can just see the woman nodding her head every month. Oh, you don't know what it's like having to have a husband. Oh, if you only knew. Believe you me, I am a husband. I have a wife. I can imagine. I say that only half facetiously, mind you. You see, we are taught that when Mashiach comes, which is the metaphor used for the rectification of the sin of Adam, we are here said that these curses are going to be absolved and woman will no longer be submissive to her husband. She will be equal to him as it originally was. I find it psychologically valid that the vast majority of women today truly crave to be married. It is very important within their psyche to have a husband. Our modern Western civilization truly endeavors to place a spike in the heart of these fundamental feminine psychological realities and truly confuses the feminine psyche today to try to make women like men, to try to, in their own way, absolve these curses. But they don't realize until there can be a fundamental spiritual and physiological transformation into the entire species of humanity these things will never truly evolve or be repaired. And therefore, all they're doing is leading to confusion and harm and truly greater femininity in Western civilization is truly abused, despised, and rejected, wherein which women are told, be men or be whores, but don't be anything in between, like a matriarch. And that to me is such a terrible, terrible crime against femininity in general. When the sin, this fall, is rectified, and we're able to integrate physical with spiritual again, we can then know that physiologically, women's menstruation will cease. Pregnancy will be a matter of consciousness, not just natural. And it will no longer be a pain-experiencing phenomenon. That hasn't occurred yet. We say that these things will happen when Mashiach comes, but he's not going to wave a magic wand and poof, twinkle, twinkle, things change. There will be a natural process of evolution, transformation, back to where we were originally, undoing the act of what we did. So again, to reflect back, when we talk about original sin, there's no such thing as an original sin. However, we are nonetheless in a fallen state. There's a big difference between the two, sin being a choice, fallen state being we're not at the level of where we once were. And all of our human history is geared towards getting us back to where we once were so that we can progress and proceed upon what our original course was in the beginning. To Adam. You listened to your wife. God doesn't say you weren't supposed to. So you listened to your wife and you ate from the tree? I gave you specific orders? Don't eat? Therefore, you're not cursed. Because I understand you. But your wife, who's closely connected to the earth, through whom you are connected to the earth itself, your source, Adam from Adama, remember the source there? I am going to curse it. You will derive your food in anguish all the days of your life. It will bring forth thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the grass of the fields. By the sweat of your brow will you eat bread. What does that mean? Adam was in a garden. In a garden, everything is provided for you, the great ease. God now said, Sabbath is over, buddy. Time for the work week. It's time to go to work. You're going to have to now bust your chops to go make a living. You're no longer in the rose garden. You're now out in the jungle. That's what he says here. By the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat bread. It's as if it's a curse and a commandment at the same time to go and work. And every one of us knows, boy, oh boy, is that true. Finally, you will return to the ground, for it is from the ground that you were taken, your dust, and to the dust you shall return. That's actually almost like a blessing. God says, you got stuck here in the physical world, right? Well, I will extract you from the physical world and return you to your spiritual source, which is the Garden of Eden. But you're not going to be able to come back and forth at will. That's going to be your punishment. And the next thing that happens, right? They get kicked out. Before that, it says, God, man named his wife Chava, from the root of Chai, which means the mother of all life. And then it says, God made leather garments for Adam and Eve, and he clothed them. These leather garments, where did the leather come from? The rabbis of the mystical tradition teach that this was the metaphor of Adam and Eve being placed into physical bodies of flesh and blood, like we speak of today. There is actually a very interesting story stated that the garments that we were cloaked in were the skins of the unicorn, that a sacrifice was made in order to accomplish the skins. Because we know it was the unicorn skins that covered the Ark of the Covenant in the days of the tabernacle. But that story aside, we understand that this is the beginning of physicality, of man upon the earth. Like I said, if you had lungs and gills, you can live both above and below the water. But if you lose your gills, you can't stay below the water. Adam lost his spiritual component. Now, it didn't leave him. It got enclosed, encased within this physical body, and he had no access to it, and therefore couldn't stay in that environment which naturally supported it, this place called the Garden of Eden. God said, man has now become like one of us. Oh, that terrible plural word again. Who is he talking to? Obviously, he's talking to the other angels. These seraphim, who have been around for, from man's point of view, billions of years, who are God's messengers, his intermediaries, the ones who he sets up to rule things. He says, they now know good and evil. They know the physicality. They know the spirituality. What would happen now if he took from the tree of life and lived forever? Meaning, would reinforce this state of imbalance into a place of permanency. We can't allow that. And therefore, passage to the tree of life was blocked. You see, the tree of life is always given to be a metaphor of the Holy Torah itself. And we are told that you can eat of the tree of the fruit of life on condition that you first detach yourself from physical world. Or in other words, following the pursuit of spiritual religious studies enables us to taste of higher wisdom, intelligence, which is truly what we refer to as the fruit of the tree of life. But that can only be when one leaves behind his world to embrace the spiritual matters. But we're taught again, over and over again, nothing wrong with the physical world. It's not like this is a one-way trip and you go there only one time. We eat of the fruit of the tree of life, metaphorically, by our proper behavior, our pursuit of wisdom, intelligence, cultivating and developing that true essence within us which makes us human. But God warns us, that ain't easy. We were kicked out of the garden to work the ground from which we were taken. We got to go make a living. We can't just sit back to pursue philosophical pursuits, all the while thinking that we can just go outside and pluck fruit off our tree and eat. No. We have to go out and work hard to make a living, to provide for our families and our world, to create a decent, moral, stable society. And if we have enough spare time, then we can pursue intellectual, academic, or spiritual pursuits, which we've always been encouraged to do. We were driven away from the garden, and the Kiruvim angels, different type of angels, are placed at the east along with the revolving sword blade to guard the path to the tree of life. And that ends our chapter. Now, what is this revolving sword? Very important, and we recognize it. Spiritual accomplishments, which we call the fruit of the tree of knowledge, don't come easy. Actually, they come rather hard. Now, you can acquire academic knowledge. You can open up your Bible and memorize it from beginning to end. That is not the fruit of the tree of life. Fruit of the tree of life is spiritual awareness, true deep contemplation, an inner reality, an expansion of consciousness of the nature of the universe. You might say, gee, that's cool. But it's clearly documented by none less than Jungian psychoanalysis that any type of psychological growth is barred, blocked by irrational fear and psychological prejudice. People don't want to know. People don't like to know. People are afraid of change and everything that it entails. And that understanding is the fundamental of religious fundamentalism and why you have so many people who are afraid to truly experience and all they want to do is learn by rote. And they will claim that to be the fruit of the tree of life when it is none other the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and it contains good and evil. Knowledge detached from experience always has the potential of being evil. And as long as we human beings have within us both the potential of good and evil, then there's always that potential for us to take something good and turn it into something bad. So chapter 3 concludes with the beginning of the history of man on earth. And God be willing, in our next chapter 4, that's exactly where we will pick up. Baruch Adonai Olam. Amen. Amen.